Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 15th of December 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And I'm going to say straight off, I didn't expect to be back today, but I am. And I'm going to thank the excellent staff in the NHS for delivering me here on time. I think credit where it's due. Yes. It was excellent, Mike, yeah. I have to say. So let's get some positive vibes out there. Big problems in the NHS, but the staff who dealt with me, at least, were really wonderful.
Yeah, we'll just get straight on with Theresa May, of course, back from the European Council meeting. And apparently she has accepted plans that we will not be discussing trade initially in the next stage of Brexit talks. Instead, we're going to focus as a priority on the transition period. Brian, I'm just going to ask you straight away how this is possible. So this is not a literal quote that I've got on screen at the moment. This is a summary of what she's saying. But for the next stage, we'll be focusing on the transition agreement. My top priority is Britain's deep and special relationship with the European Union. But perhaps, because it goes completely over my head, but perhaps, Brian, you could explain to me how it's possible to transition something to something that you don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, Mike? Well, right, your suggestion was because she already knows where she's going. She knows what has already been agreed. So she knows it, the public don't, but she can concentrate on the transition. Or else this is pure obfuscation. This is about just making things more opaque, more complicated, and chewing up more time so Brexit is delayed.
Absolutely. Well, these are the possibilities, and, we have our views. But anyway, the main focus, as we mentioned yesterday, on the day's events was the EU military, which is shiny and new, and here they all are. This is the EU military. It's fantastic looking, isn't it?
I'd love to put them on the battlefield, actually. They can be in the trenches up front, all of them. I think it'd be really good.
Right. So there you go. That's what they look like. There are some uniforms in there, as well as the politicians that are going to be sending people to die. Let's have a look at what Ms. Mogherini, Federica Mogherini, the High Representative of the European Union, had to say yesterday about this. Now, we're going to discuss this as we go, because some of the things she said were pretty spectacular. Here we go.
No. First of all, let me say that today is an historic day, because exactly 10 years after the signing of the Lisbon Treaty, we turn into reality one of the provisions of the treaty. The permanent structure cooperation was launched on Monday by the foreign ministers of 25 member states. So an historic decision that turns the European Union into a credible security provider globally.
Right. So the European Union, Brian, is now a global security provider.
Yeah, it's something.
It's a commercial arrangement. They go to South Sudan or something, and they make some kind of commercial arrangement with the Sudanese people, and they say, we'll come in with our EU military and we'll provide you with security, in inverted commas, in return for contracts. Is that what that's about?
Well, it's global corporatist language on one hand, so perhaps they're using it because this is now showing the real power of the banks and the procurers of the defence military infrastructure, or else they have to use this kind of term, because if they talk about the European defence system, they are talking about the unification plans, and they don't want the British public in particular to realise that that is exactly what's happening.
So let's continue.
We'll now have 17 concrete projects on which the 25 member states that have launched the permanent structural cooperation will start to work together with us, and the work will continue. I have already my team at work to launch further work on the European Union security and defence, not only the implementation of these 17 projects, but also we can work at the possibility to deploy one of our battle groups.
Right. So can I just get this correct? They are now looking for an opportunity to deploy one of their battle groups. They are actively seeking an opportunity. Are they going to create this opportunity? Is maybe UK aid is going to create this opportunity?
Well, remember that Theresa May was effectively talking about a new Operation Barbarossa against Russia, where she was talking about the importance of the grain and the and the oil. So maybe they're winding up somewhere in Eastern Europe to then have a go at the Russians. But they want to play with their new toy, obviously.
Clearly.
In one of the theater crises that we have around the world, we can work at the establishment of a European facility for peace.
Right. Now, pay attention. A facility for peace, Brian, a facility for peace.
It's a battle group for peace.
Well, absolutely.
I'm going to suggest that in the next multi-annual financial framework, we will set up this facility to finance the level of ambition we have on security and defense, so that this Europe of defense and security is also financed at the adequate level. This is not going to be a militarization of the European Union budget, but it's going to be a way of being more flexible, more agile, and more operational whenever.
So, what do we say about that?
Well, it's double speak. Actually, it's a complete lie, because they are now setting up the financial arrangements to pay for unified EU military structure. She says, of course, it isn't, but of course it is.
So, but it's finance for peace.
In the form of a battle group,
yes.
It's needed. And we see that around the world, there is a strong need for the European Union to be active as a point of reference, as a player, as others are taking different directions. And I will also set up now, in the coming days, a task force here in Brussels to coordinate the different strands of work on the European Union of Security and Defence. I have to say, this is also the best way to honour the Lisbon Treaty that, as you know, created my role as the double hat, Vice President of the Commission, High Representative. It works, it has delivered, and now we have to continue coordinating all the different policies, Commission, Council, European Defence Agency, Member States.
Spectacular, isn't it?
So she the has self-praise, yes. Was just wonderful there. Drifted in. I've got two hats. I was given those two hats. I've done a brilliant job. Well done, me.
So, David, we've covered quite a lot there, but this is spectacular from Ms. Mogherini.
It certainly is. So it's very clear that what Jean-Claude Juncker, the EU president, called the sleeping beauty of the Lisbon Treaty, is sleeping no more. It's very much alive. And as Ms. Mogherini said, it works.
Yes. Well, look, just before we move on from defence, I just want to draw people's attention to this, because apparently the RAF has a new squadron, Brian. This is fantastic. It's number 12 squadron. Well, this has been announced by Harriet Baldwin. It follows Gavin Williamson's who's the Defence Secretary. It follows his trip to Doha last week, where he agreed a package of training and cooperation between the British and the Qatari Air Forces. And, of course, he also sold a bunch of Typhoon aircraft. And so what they've agreed to do is to set up number 12 squadron, and it will temporarily, they say, integrate Qatari personnel, including pilots and ground crew, based at RAF Collingsby in Lincolnshire. So, Brian, I don't know what thoughts you've got on that. Harriet Baldwin said, just by the way, that Qatar proudly becomes the ninth nation to buy the world's leading multi-role combat aircraft. The formation of a joint squadron means the RAF will take the lead in providing training and support to the Qatari Emirates.
So something's brewing in the Middle East, Mike, aren't they? We shouldn't forget, of course, the new Royal Navy base in Bahrain. That was talked about a while ago. It's now gone completely silent, but apparently we want assets in the region, a formation of this squadron. So we haven't got the forces ourselves, so we embed people in order to direct these so-called lesser nations. There's something very, very sinister, I think, forming.
Yes. Right. Now, one of the, key areas that we've been researching and commenting on for a number of years now is that of behavioural change. And we've discussed behavioural change in economics. We've discussed behavioural change in politics with the Behavioural Insights team and the Cabinet Office Behavioural Change Projects and so on, and Common Purpose over the years. But one area where we haven't looked particularly closely at behavioural change is healthcare. And so I'm glad to welcome Dr. Graham Downing to the programme. Hello, Graham. How's things going? And this is an area that you've been looking into now, and we're going to just run through a few pieces on this. It is something which seems to be at the heart of the political scene at the moment. But to see this moving into healthcare is not the best thing that we've seen, I think.
Yeah, hi, Michael Bryan. This is that guy there. His name's Kendall Taylor, Nat Kendall Taylor, and he's the head guy of something called Frameworks. And what they do is effectively they analyze, for example, social media. They'll analyze people. They analyze how they think and how they express themselves, how they feel, and they do this for one purpose and one purpose only: is to work out what makes them tick. And how to reverse engineer to get them to believe whatever message they've been paid to tell these people. So they're kind of hired guns in a way. And the reason why I highlighted that is I had an advanced copy. I did give you the slide. I'm not sure if you've got it there. Oh, you've got it on the screen, I think, which is lessons learned from diverse efforts to change social norms and opportunities and strategies to promote behavioral change and behavioral health. Now, they were looking at mental health a lot there as well. But this was presented at National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine. So this is at the highest level. And they've got these guys in now saying, well, this is how we do it. This is how we look at people. And really, when you're on social media, what you don't realize is all your data is being analyzed by these people. And they do it for one purpose only, is how to suss out to get you to believe what they want you to believe. And I think that's terrible. I mean, you know, I mean, it's a simple thing for me to say, really, but it is terrible. You know, we don't want people doing this sort of stuff.
Right. So, Graham, you've highlighted a couple of quotes out of this. First of all, Mr. Kendall Taylor, then describes the research process carried out by the Frameworks Institute to discover the cultural models that shape people's thinking. He said that the objective was to uncover the cultural assumptions behind the patterned ways in which people answered open-ended questions.
Yeah, and he was presenting to these academies how they go about what they do, how they go about finding out how you think, how you feel, what cultural influences you've got, and then how they target their message to you to get you to buy into whatever they've been told to get you to buy into. And when we move on from this, you start to get into the next publication and meetings at the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering and Medicine. You see where they're going with this, because it starts to get into vaccines and what they call vaccine hesitancy.
So this one is building communication capacity to counter infectious disease threats.
This is Dana Maron, and I think she's one of the editors at Scientific American. She's a huge publication. She looks very young. They all look very young, these people. Maybe we're just getting older, I don't know. And she talks about social media, and they're talking about, yeah, it's a great thing. We can use it for great, but also we've got to watch it, and we've got to be very careful with it. And she was giving expert advice to health experts, and she said, look, in terms of practical advice for public health experts and responders, Maron recommended being vigilant online to see what information and misinformation are spreading, perhaps even making that task part of someone's job. And when you move on to the next slide, you're going to see that's already been done. It already is someone's job. And the lady you've got on there, if you might want to read something off that.
Right, it says Dr. Heidi J. Larson is an anthropologist and director of the Vaccine Confidence Project, professor of anthropology, risk and decision science, Department of Infectious Disease Epidemiology, SHTM, associate clinical professor, Department of Global Health, University of Washington, and the Chatham House Center on Global Health Security fellow. Dr. Larson previously headed Global Immunization Communication at UNICEF, chaired Gavi's Advocacy Task Force, and served on the WHO SAGE Working Group on Vaccine Hesitancy. The VCP is a WHO Centre of Excellence on addressing vaccine hesitancy. Dr. Larson's research focused on the analysis of social and political factors that can affect uptake of health interventions and influence policies. Her particular interest is on risk and rumour management from clinical trials to delivery and building public trust. She served on the FDA Medical Countermeasure Emergency Communications Expert Working Group and is a principal investigator of the EU-funded project on the development, acceptance and compliance of an Ebola vaccine trial in Sierra Leone.
I mean, there's a mouthful just in that lot. I mean, you've only got, I stay to my field, but I'm reasonably informed enough to see things like Chatham House start coming up and other things. And you guys, I'm sure, could spin off quite a lot and talk about those places. But what this suggests to us is this woman is very, very deep into the systems that you guys and the systems of government and the deep systems of government and what you guys would call the deep state. And if you look at her, her bio there, it really exemplifies that perfectly. And what's incredible, did you know all these groups were going on? Did you know that the FDA had a medical countermeasure emergency communication expert working group? I mean, who'd have thought that we were such a threat? All these people here that chat and talk about vaccines, that they've got to have expert emergency communication groups to meet and discuss how they're going to tackle people that just query and just ask questions on social media about global health intervention. And just the word global, every time you hear that word global, 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 you know, you really, the hairs on the back of your neck should stand up, because these are people who really are just centralizing power. And really, when you look at the research, and as we progress on further, you'll see how disconnected these people actually are.
In this one, it says that she began a presentation by quoting Margaret Chan, director of the World Health Organization, who said the days when health officials could issue advice based on the very best medical and scientific data and expect populations to comply may be fading. She noticed that changing maybe in that quotation to R would reflect the reality of what she called the post-fact society. This is kind of the same narrative that we've had with the so-called post-truth society and fake news and so on. So there seems to be some overlap there. It goes on to say Larson's program, the Vaccine Confidence Project, acts as a surveillance system for public opinion on vaccines. The vaccine issue she worries about the most relates to how the world behaved in regard to the H1N1 outbreak and what she called the horrible worldwide non-compliance around the vaccine. There's a quote here. She said, it is not just the end users. We have people in the middle, the gatekeepers, the health professionals, and the gatekeepers outside of our health community that we need to put under our lens. That sounds pretty...
Orwellian, I think.
Yeah, indeed.
There's the reason why, okay, there's two people, there's a one person mentioned there, Chan, okay, kind of head of the World Health Organization. And I did send you the last quote, which hopefully will get us to mention when you see just where this woman's coming from. Put her to the side for the second. What they're suggesting is the assumption has been made by these people that everything that has been said, everything's been done, the research is all there, and you can't question anything. Anything that questions is post-fact. There is absolutely no science to back that up. In fact, the opposite. The minute you stop talking about science is the minute it becomes unscientific. We then start to become fake science if we don't challenge it. And it's the same within politics. And what she's saying is, look, they're being challenged now by not just people outside of the medical community, but people in the medical community. And she said, we've now got to put those under our lens. And what they're doing is they're monitoring all of us. It's outrageous. Now, if you look at that quote in big letters on the, just very quickly before you go on to the next slide, Mike, she said, look, she noted that this non-compliance was not just the US or European phenomenon, it's worldwide. And the Indian Ministry of Health called her up and said, why are 85% of our nurses and trained healthcare professionals in one of India's states refusing the vaccine? And because people are starting to think and they're starting to realize that maybe not all is what it says on the tin with these things.
So we've got The Guardian here. Not quite sure when this. Oh, this is from 2009. So the headline is Swine Flu, a panic stoked in order to posture and spend. It's by Simon Jenkins. And you've got a quote here. It says, we have gone demented. Two Britons are or were not very ill from flu. This could really explode, intones a reporter for BBC News. London warned, it's here, cries the Evening Standard. Fear is said to be spreading like a Mexican wave. It could affect 750,000 Britons. It could cost $3 trillion. The danger, according to the radio, is that workers who were not ill will be worried, perhaps by the reporter, and fail to turn up at power stations and hospitals. Appropriately, they panicked. On Monday, ministers plunged into their Cobra bunker beneath Whitehall to prepare for the worst. Had Tony Blair been about, there would have been germ warfare suits. British government is barking mad.
Well, I mean, how many times have we seen this with the SARS, the bird flu, with this swine flu, with Ebola? And he's quite right. And, you know, I've given you some examples there of what maybe Dr. Larson would like to look at, because bearing in mind she's in charge of all this, of monitoring us all and getting us to, with all these other experts like Nat Kendall Taylor, to try and find out how they can make us take this stuff and change the way we think, and publishing data that is being which is being looked at the highest level, highest levels. So these people are influencing policy, and influencing what happens to us. And when, and the reason I've picked this example, what she said, is because she's talking about swine flu. She's so upset that we didn't get everyone to take the swine flu thing. Now we're going to pull that apart through these next slides. And that's an introduction first to say, well, there may be a lot more was going on with this swine flu than what we originally thought. And if you show Sharon, I think you've got it up on screen, which is Cheryl Atkinson. She was an award-winning reporter. And I think she worked for CBS News. And she broke a story on this, and she went through and she looked at it. She first of all went to try and find out data on who's actually got swine flu. And she went to the officials and they didn't give her the information. So she went to each individual state in America, quite a few of them, and she got individual data. And the bottom left kind of pie charts there, a little flow diagram of pie charts, tells you that hardly anyone had flu, let alone had swine flu. Of all these people they were diagnosing, I mean, in one state, Florida, only 17% of what they, of who they stated had swine flu only had it. In another state, it was 2%. Another one, it was only 1%. In another one, only 2%. So what they did was they grossly inflated these figures. Whether they did it deliberately or not, or just through panic or whatever, they grossly inflated these figures. And you see this with when they have these kind of panics over, you know, pandemics. Now, that's bad enough. Now, they should have then said, right, let's have a halt to this, because there's obviously not this big thing going on that we think is going on. But what they did was they then stopped reporting the figures. Now, they made a conscious decision. CDC, Centers for Disease Control, said stop reporting the figures, because they knew if you reported the figures, the game would be up. Obviously, they were not looking out, based on these data, they were not looking out for the for us. They were looking out for a different interest, because if not, then why did they stop reporting the data when it was showing that no one really had swine flu?
So we've got a couple of other examples, one from the Mail here, the false pandemic drugs firms cashed in on scare over swine flu, claims Euro Health Chief. From Boston.com, two medical reports accuse WHO. The WHO of exaggerating H1N1 threat. And you're featuring a guy called Wolfgang Vodarg here.
Yeah, and he's part of the whole EU thing. I mean, like the Council of Europe. I mean, this guy was pretty high up. He's a medical physician. I mean, I put his credentials on there, and he rung the alarm bells. And he said the WHO, this is his direct quote from him, in collaboration with big pharmaceutical companies and their scientists redefined pandemics, and they lowered the alarm threshold. So they reset the alarm so that it would be triggered quicker once you started to raise concern over certain infections. Okay, and so they did that first. And then those new standards forced politicians in order to go and buy the drugs that the vaccines, same difference, that these drug companies were selling. And he said never before the search for traces of a virus was carried out so broadly and intensively. Besides, many cases of death that happened just to coincide with a seropositive H1N1 lab findings were simply attributed to the swine flu and used to foster fear. He states directly it was a con.
Yeah.
It was a total con.
Okay, look, we'll move through to this one, which is deaths of from pneumonia influenza in 122 cities. And the point you're making here is that there were more deaths in the 3 years prior to 2009?
There was, absolutely. You know, swine flu, I mean, no one wants to die from anything, for God's sake, but, you know, the deaths during the so-called swine flu pandemic were the least they had in years. The prior 3 years were worse. So they lowered the threshold, the alarm threshold. Certain individuals went and warned that we've got a problem. They almost forced these governments into buying this stuff. And the vaccines, and then and what we're not mentioning here, Mike, is I did give you a paper, a reference on what the swine flu has done. They calculated data, and Dr. Goldberg published a paper and said that more deaths, more spontaneous abortions happened, more stillbirths happened during the time when people had that vaccine plus a normal flu vaccine. And also, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people were paralyzed due to something called Guillain-Barré syndrome. So there's a lot of damage that was caused by this. But And the British Medical Journal published a whole letter saying that WHO had lost credibility. But you know what? It was a great success because the drug companies made between $7 and $10 billion, I think it was dollars, out of it.
Yeah.
And it's an absolute disgrace. And the reason I'm pointing this out is the head person, Dr. Larson, who's so worried about no one took this vaccine in 2017, all these years later, uses that as an example of why they need to push ahead and surveil us and do all this sort of stuff. It's an outrage.
Yeah, so the two people you're highlighting here are not Kendall Taylor, but Dr. Heidi Larson. And is this the quote that you wanted to highlight here? The days when health officials could issue advice based on the very best medical and scientific data and expect population to comply are fading. And then you finish off by saying the vaccine issue she worries about the most relates to how the world behaved with regard to H1N1 and what she called the horrible worldwide non-compliance around the vaccine. So they've got to change our behaviour.
Exactly. But she's completely not, she's unhinged. Well, I'm not going to say she's unhinged from the data. Even the leading medical journals and everyone else seems to know that was a big con to sell. And there's a much darker side to that we don't have time to get into, but maybe we'll do something on that at some time in the future. Is this is the woman who's in charge. This is the woman who's surveilling you or what you're writing on social media, and they're working out how they can get you to believe what they want to believe. She's the trusted person at the helm, and yet she doesn't even seem to understand that what her perfect example she's using to drive this forward was a complete con.
Yeah. Okay, Graham, thank you very much for that. Much appreciated. We will speak again very soon, I hope.
And we can encourage people to research for themselves. So Graham's given a pointer at where to be looking. Go away and research this information for yourselves.
Right. Now, let's move to the BBC. And David, Belfast Telegraph here is reporting that the BBC has been using the regulatory powers act, the terrorism laws to catch people who are not paying their TV licence.
The BBC is using anti-terror spy laws, writes the Belfast Telegraph, to trap licence fee dodgers in Northern Ireland. And it transpires, not just Northern Ireland. Just one little comment from that article, which is particularly sinister. A TV licensing spokesperson said the average evasion rate remains at a low of 5 to 6%, meaning 94 to 95% of homes are correctly licensed. So in their view, there are two options. You are correctly licensed or you are evading the license. There doesn't seem to be any third option where you actually don't have a TV. But there you go. Now, this has been generated through a firm called Capita. Capita have the contract, which they won in 2011. It's an 8-year contract, goes up to 2019, to collect the BBC's license fee, all 3.7 billion of it from 96% of UK households every year. And the BBC seem extremely happy at their efficiency. Now, what's the reason I'm raising this is that it transpires that in Scotland as well, RIPSA, the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Scotland Act, is being used to spy on Scottish people in order to find out if they are evading the licence fee. Now, the specifics for this are quite interesting because a person who doesn't have a television licence and was having a lot of hassle from Capita contacted their internet service provider and put in a Freedom of Information request to see if there'd been any contact. And the response made it clear that not only had there been contact, but Capita had applied under RIPSA to receive the confidential information and had been provided with everything, full browsing history, emails, the lot. Now, this means that this has gone through the courts in Scotland. A sheriff must have signed off on this and issued the warrant. All of this was done in secret. We don't know how much of this is happening. And then that means that this person's internet service provider provided his browsing history, and Capita are presumably scanning this to find out if he's been using BBC iPlayer or some other service which will allow them to find him.
David, this fits in very nicely with what we've been reporting during the week with private security firm, private investigative firms putting people in amongst campaign groups and trying to gather information. But I wasn't aware that the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act, whether it be in Scotland or the rest of the UK, was for the use of commercial organisations. I thought it was for the use of the security services and the police. This is something I think that as a general observation, people probably aren't aware of.
Well, when it was sold to us, it was sold as necessary protection against terror, against the nasty terrorists, as so many of these things are. But of course, it grows and grows, and we're seeing it used by local authorities for perhaps tax evasion or something like this, and by a whole host here of private companies looking to gather in information. So yes, it's grown beyond its original advertised purpose very greatly.
Okay, well, let's move on. And David, last week's coverage of the issues over the Shatter Boys, there was quite a response to it.
There was quite an angry response on social media. There was a lot of support on social media as well for what we're saying, which I'll come to if I may. So the way we're driving with this, there's been a response from the head of Shatter Boys, Daniel Wilson Croft, via a blog called the Outlaw Blog, and I've got a couple of extracts just to comment on here. He says that Companies House had been contacted about this, and said it was a tight, and said that the name, whether his name is Wilson Croft or Wilson Home, and said it was typed incorrectly. The necessary forms have been submitted to remedy this error. So that's what he said publicly. Couple of questions about that. How would Companies House know whether the typing was correct or incorrect? And I spoke to Companies House this morning, and they had no record of anything being supplied to change the name. They said, quote, nothing has been received. So that doesn't seem to be entirely consistent. Mr. Wilson Croft also said, I personally have high level security clearance through the Home Office, and my name is Daniel Mark Wilson Croft. Now, this refers presumably to the fact he's on the government inquiry into child sexual abuse in the panel of victims and survivors who are advising them. And this is something that we see in Scotland as well, and it's very strange because the people who are invited onto these government inquiries are often individuals who run very small organisations or essentially personal organisations. A lot of them are run, in Scotland at any rate, in quite a chaotic fashion, whereas large, well-organised charities with a long track record of looking after child sexual abuse victims are excluded from core participation status or being in full involvement with the government investigation. And it's very strange as to why the government is choosing certain people and not certain others. And that concerns me quite a bit. Now, he also said, quote, Shatter Boys does not even have a bank account because one of the directors had bad credit with the bank we approached to open an account. We have received numerous donations, which has helped us travel and see clients up and down the country, and run numerous events, end quote. Now, this also throws up some questions. It's unusual, very unusual, but not unknown for a limited company not to have a bank account. But that presumably means that the banking facilities have been run through the director's personal bank account. So that does raise some questions. Now, how much money has actually gone through this? Mr. Wilson Croft says that he's essentially subsidising this organisation, making nothing from it. Are there formal accounts? Can this actually be substantiated? There obviously, it gets very complicated with if the tax authorities get involved in this sort of thing, because unless there's proper accounts, these things will be viewed as a director's loan, and it gets very complicated indeed. And I'll close on this one. He said the Companies House registration was pointless and means little, quoting Daniel Wollstonecroft again. It means little as it has no impact on how we work. It seemed like a good idea at the time, but it's caused more trouble than it's worth. And this is the reason it's getting dissolved, because a letter has been sent to confirm, because no letter has been sent to confirm that we want to stay open. So the organisation has been wound down after a year, no accounts ever produced. This is not the sort of organisation that you would normally expect to be chosen by the government to represent victims and survivors at the official inquiry. It's understandable given maybe where the Shatter Boys came from, but it seems a strange place that they've been put at the very sort of head of the government inquiry, very head of the victims and survivors representation on that inquiry. Now, speaking to some of the people in Manchester who were part of Shatter Boys, they made it clear that what this organisation started off was a group of regular men who had been abused and were in pain and were meeting to help one another. And that's something we can all applaud. It seems to have changed, and there are questions when it becomes a limited company, when it starts raising money, things have to be done correctly. And this is why we're asking questions, in order to promote that. Now, I'd like to finish here. I've got a quote from Robert Green, because I've been discussing what's been happening with people in this movement to defend child sexual abuse victims and survivors. And Robert Green's comment, he said, absolute commitment is required, and it's vital to signal to the corrupt authorities that they are not feared. We believe in truth, compassion, justice and clarity. Our opponents, predominantly bullies and cowards, choose to live under stones. Transparency is our greatest weapon and our opponent's greatest weakness. It is the one that is most likely to take the people to victory. And I thought that was excellent. And that's why we're calling on transparency. And that's why we're saying that all the organisations involved in the fight against child sexual abuse have to be completely upfront, completely clear on their dealings, and scrupulously honest, because anything less will be exploited by those who wish to cover this up and keep everything in the dark and maintain the situation, which, let's not forget, has been industrial-scale child sexual abuse endorsed and covered up by the authorities in this country for years.
Yeah. Any thoughts?
Well, I think it's important to get to the bottom of it. Perhaps we can say quite strongly that we do appreciate a number of people have got concerns that UK Column has asked questions. I think I'm right in saying we have given the opportunity for the gentleman to actually come on and speak live on UK Column, but that offer wasn't taken up. So at the moment, there are some grey areas, and we think it's right to ask questions.
Final comment, Dimit?
I would just like to say there was, I raised last week whether it was the same Daniel Wollstonecraft who had been involved in the fraud, and point out that we didn't know this. I raised this because it had been circulating on social media, and I thought it was important to point out that there was no link that was established between this man and the person who had committed the fraud. Mr. Wollstonecraft has made it very clear that it's not him. He's stated that categorically, and I think it'd be fair to him to point that out today.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, let's move on to Scottish issues and Scottish tax, David. Scotland did lag behind UK with growth below 1% until 2022. That's in the Scotsman, but the BBC pointing out that NPI is heading forward with some income tax changes. And I saw a press release or something from HMRC over the last couple of days, which was really making the point that if you're moving to Scotland, you've got to contact them and make sure that you're on the correct tax code. So what is going on with tax in Scotland?
Well, we're a different country, as you know. All things are different here, north of the border. And what we're seeing is the effect of a slowing economy. For the last 10 years, it coincides with the election of the SNP government, as it happens. Not cause and effect, I'm sure. Growth has been falling in Scotland and falling below the UK average, whereas it was very similar before. It's facing slow productivity growth and a situation made worse by an ageing population. That's quite strange in some ways, because up until 50s, 60s, you actually get more efficient. The tax system is now entirely different, with different tax rates. Everyone, the cut-off point's about £26,000. Below that level, you'll get less tax, £20 a year off your tax. Above that level, you're taxed more highly, with the highest rate earners paying another £1,774 per year. So that will be a disincentive for hard work and enterprise in Scotland, which would be the very reverse of the correct policy, given the fact that we have a productivity crisis.
Indeed. Okay. Brian, the Russians.
Yes, the nasty Russians are at it again. And I just had to pick up on this one. Here's the front page from the illustrious BBC news website. This is the article that had caught my attention here. It says, Russia, a new risk to undersea cables. Chief of Defence Staff Sir Stuart Peach warns disruption to undersea cables could be catastrophic. The images change on this little one, and this is the cable, so you might not be able to see it as it's quite small, but those are the cables. They do change to a nasty Russian submarine just to ram things home. Well, I dug into this story and I found it fascinating, because here's the BBC in the main article reporting the Chief of Defence Staff, Sir Peach, saying that Russia was a risk to undersea cables. And he was giving a warning on this. This is grossly misleading stuff. I think it's significant he's talking at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. I'm sure if we had David Ellis with us today, he would say, well, remember to put the EU in front of that, because it's really UC. This is an EU-biased institution. But let's see how the spin is conducted. So the headline, an image suggests to the reader that it is the British military warning of cuts to undersea cable or an attack on undersea cables. And this is reinforced by the opening text. So here we are. It says the UK's most senior military officers warned of a new threat posed by Russia to communications and internet cables that run under the sea. And it goes on with this statement. Air Chief Marshal Sir Stuart Peach, the chief of the defence staff, said Britain and NATO needed to prioritise protecting the lines of communication. So the whole thing hinges on this is new, apparently, Mike. This is a new threat, we are to believe. Those nasty Russians are doing something they've never done before. Well, we get into the article a bit more, and what do we see here? Well, he said it would be catastrophic hit on the economy if the cables were cut or disrupted. The BBC then gets the hit in. Could Russian submarines cut off the internet? That's there in the story. But where's this story really come from? Well, it's actually really come from the Policy Exchange think tank. And this is where we are now starting to see media spin, which is really fascinating. So Policy Exchange, UK think tank, we're an educational charity whose mission is to develop and promote new policy ideas that deliver better public services. So we've now got a charity advising us on defence, but is it really Policy Exchange that's advising? Because here's the document that it's all based on: undersea cables, indispensable, insecure. It's got a foreword by Admiral James Stiridis, if I pronounce that correctly, United States Navy retired, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander, Europe. So it appears to be military, but if we get into it, it's not, because it's been put together by an MP called Rishi Sunak MP. Let's have a look at him. Well, if you go to his website, he's into lovely little communities up north, farming, sheep.
Rural affairs. Because you've got lots of communications cables running across the fields.
Well, this
there.
Is the fascinating thing. I called his office this morning to ask if he'd got any experience whatsoever, personal experience in undersea cables or indeed undersea warfare. I wasn't able to get a response, but it was indicated to me that he really didn't. I've also spoken to Policy Exchange this morning and asked the same question. They more or less admitted that he didn't have any experience, but he did write this paper, apparently. Right. He dropped the sheep and he set to, and he started to write the paper. And at the end of the paper, it gives itself credit, because Admiral James Stiridis, US Navy retired, says Policy Exchange's excellent report shines a fresh light on a growing threat. But the report itself admits that it loosely hangs off the Admiral's work in the first place. So we've got a nice circuitous tale here. Then we've got General Lord Nicholas Horton saying a very compelling summary of genuine strategic vulnerability. And we've even got Robert Hannigan, former Prime Minister Security Advisor and former Director of GCHQ, saying, well, it's good that the Policy Exchange has pointed all this out to us. So they didn't know. We are to believe that senior military people and GCHQ had no idea that there was a threat to undersea cables.
Right.
So let's see the man in action. Here he is, Sir Stuart Peach. I've said he's delivering what I would regard as a lemon speech. He says, in response to the threat posed by the modernisation of the Russian Navy, both nuclear and conventional submarines and ships, we, along with our Atlantic allies, have prioritised missions and tasks to protect the sea lines of communication. And I've added to that, we've done this by scrapping three perfectly good anti-submarine aircraft carriers, scrapping the entire Nimrod maritime patrol fleet without replacement. We've wrecked the nuclear submarine fleet. We've wrecked the surface ships, and we've got cuts to the Army and RAF. The big lie with this, Mike, is, of course, this is not a new threat. This is a threat that has existed since the first cable was laid down in 1858. But if we go back to the Cold War, this was always a risk that these cables could be attacked and you needed the protection. But in the policy exchange report, it does not mention at all that, of course, the government has cut the very forces necessary to protect it. So this is not a new Russian threat. This is a threat which has now come to the fore because of government cuts, but policy exchange didn't want to deal with that aspect. Mm. So who wrote the article? Did the MP do it on his own? I don't think so, but we're waiting to find out. But what is the spin on this article? It's those nasty Russians.
So we'll end with an email.
I think we should.
So this is an email. Is this an email you have sent to?
Well, this is the email that I've actually sent through to the MP himself. I said, "Dear Mr. Sunak, I've been alerted to the BBC report on the policy exchange report undersea cables. Can you please direct me to your personal experience in undersea cables and undersea warfare upon which you rely in making this most interesting report?" And I also say to him, you don't mention the effects of cuts that your government have made, which have created this problem.
So he is a Conservative MP?
Oh, of course. Uh-huh. And just in case there's any doubt, Policy Exchange says it's a charity, but of course, Francis Maud MP was one of the people behind the setting up of this independent non-political charity.
So it's an independent non-political Conservative charity?
Sort of, yes.
Yes, right.
But we're waiting for a formal reply from Policy Exchange as to why they left out defence cuts, and we will report accordingly if and when we receive any reply.
We should leave it there.
I think we should. We will end on a good note. We've taken delivery of more UK column pens. We can't fulfil orders before we take the break for Christmas, but in the new year...
No, I think we probably can. We're going to try and do that, yes, okay. Absolutely. So on Monday, those will go out.
Well, there we are. A live update on the success of the UK column pens. If you haven't got one, we may be able to fulfil that before Christmas, so that would be extremely good. Thank you to all the people who responded to our pleas for subscriptions and donations. And we're going to say that into the new year, we're really going to be pushing this because we would love to be expanding UK column and the breadth of reports and the number of programmes that are going out. So if you can help us with that, we would be immensely grateful. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back same time on Monday.
Bye-bye.